Well, hello there. Welcome back to another week of baseball. Baseball is played this week. Professional baseball, in fact. Amateur baseball as well, but we're obviously here to focus on the Seattle Mariners Baseball Club. Just a weird week. Just a weird week of ball, I would say. Currently, though, the Mariners, they're 31-27. They are first in the division, 3 games ahead of the second-place Rangers, and 5.5 ahead of the third-place Houston Astros, the only team with a positive run differential in this division is the Rangers with a +1 in second place. The Mariners have a -7 as they're in first. The fun differential is back. Their expected win-loss is 28-30. They're absolutely back. They're getting back to their roots, all right? The last couple of years of generally scoring more than their opponents on a given night, we're out. We're done with that. We're going back to the 2021 fun differential Seattle Mariners. And let's win the division with a negative run differential. Who says we can't do that? Let's freaking do it. But today's episode, I will be brief, but talk a little bit about some minor league call-ups to the bigs, to AAA, focus on some numbies from Luke Rayleigh, JP, Mitch Garver just played catcher. Then look ahead to the June schedule and the strength of schedule that the Seattle Mariners have left. But first and foremost, I want to say, John Stanton, if you're listening to this, I heard there's another billionaire that's going to go down to the Titanic and try to prove that it's possible. And I just think, like, doesn't that sound fun to you, Mr. Stanton? Like, doesn't that sound way more fun than owning a baseball team that is merely numbers on paper for you? What you could do is have a lived experience of going to the bottom of the ocean in a submarine with your fellow billionaires. I think it's a great idea. I think you should check it out. That's just what I wanted to say to you. If you're listening to this one, check out a submarine, man. It's a great time to do it. It's a great time of year to go down in the ocean with a submarine. And then the only other thing I did want to mention before I get into Seattle Mariners ball talk for a little while, the Negro Leagues were in the baseball news this week. MLB has officially entered them into technically the records, I guess, and like official record book on MajorLeagueBaseball.com. They have been recognized as a major league, the Negro Leagues, for a while now, but their stats were available on like Baseball Reference and to go look up elsewhere as well. And everything has been recognized like that. But they weren't like looked at on the same plane, I guess, as Major League Baseball stats. So the biggest difference here, I think Josh Gibson was essentially the poster child of this update. MLB said, okay, they had a long criteria to figure this out, which stats they're actually going to incorporate. And quite a few of them changed leaders. Josh Gibson is now, I think, the leader in like OPS total in Major League Baseball history and like slugging percentage. His home run numbers are on there. Like, there's a lot of other guys who you will see pop up. I mean, there's a lot of Negro League greats that would have went toe to toe with Major League Baseball greats at the time. They just weren't allowed to play in white organized baseball. The thing that was really interesting, and I've listened to a few podcasts this week about kind of how they determine the criteria. That was my first question of how they determined which stats were going to be used, because the Negro League season is shorter. There's less teams. And while there was a season and like a champion in the Negro Leagues, but a lot of black baseball at that time was barnstorming across the country, which these teams just formed teams together, not technically official teams, but kind of official, and barnstormed, traveled around the country and played real baseball teams. They played a lot of white baseball teams. Particularly, they came to California quite often. I read a biography about Satchel Paige. I read a lot about this. There was a big tournament in like Denver that had white baseball teams versus black baseball teams there, some of the best at the time versus each other. And were those going to be counted? I don't think those barnstorming matches are technically counted. And then like Josh Gibson technically has like 950 home runs, but those aren't all going to be counted because some of them are just not, I guess, official games. But I'm okay with how they incorporated these stats. My initial reaction to this was it is ultimately a good thing. I think it's always good when the Negro Leagues and the stars of said leagues get more shine in just baseball in general. I do, after thinking about it and listening and reading, I would recommend reading Jay Jaffe's piece at Fangraphs he released today or yesterday if you're listening to this on Friday. Really good like writing about how MLB has handled this. And while we shouldn't really be tooting MLB's horn here, and while I do ultimately think these stats being available in the record and being official records are a good thing, I think there needs to be a bigger distinction between what is Major League Baseball versus MLB, if you understand. Like, the Negro Leagues were recognized as a major league, a major baseball league. We should do Major Baseball League versus MLB. Because Major League Baseball now coming in and being like, oh no, these stats all count in the history of Major League Baseball. It's like, well, they don't for the history of MLB, organized MLB, but they do count for Major League history. Like, the Negro Leagues were separate because MLB didn't allow them to play. That's what makes them special. That's what makes them unique. And that's why those stats matter a lot. But MLB kind of swooping in here in 2024 and being like, oh no, these stats count for Major League Baseball record books. I ultimately think it's a good thing, but I think there needs to be a bigger distinction. I think there needs to be a hall of, not a hall, but record books that's just major leagues history, like major baseball leagues history. That can all have Negro Leagues, white baseball, any other professional league that happened in the late 19th century, whatever. And then there just needs to be MLB history. And MLB history is not going to have Negro League players on it because they never got to play in Major League Baseball. And people should know why they never got to play in Major League Baseball. And then they go learn about the Negro Leagues and they see, oh, Major League history, look at how good these players were, but they were never allowed to play in MLB. I don't know. It's an interesting conversation. I ultimately do think it's good that these records are like the biggest stars of those leagues will be available to see in Major League Baseball records. Although, as I said, I think there should be a bigger distinction available. I'm just thinking in terms of like a little kid who's looking at Major League Baseball records and he sees a Josh Gibson or an Oscar Charleston or Cool Papa Bell or Buck Leonard, any of the biggest Negro League stars who never made it to the MLB. And they're like, oh, who is that? Like, I've never heard of that before. And then they research and they're like, oh, there was these whole different leagues and why. I'm looking at it through that lens. I think MLB could have handled it better and should in the future handle it better. And there should be more of a distinction between Major League Baseball and organized baseball as a whole and its history. But I'm looking at it through more visibility to these stars. And I ultimately think that is a good thing. So initially I was pretty elated. And then as I thought about it more and listened to other people speak about this, I was like, yeah, no, I agree largely with like Jay Jaffe's piece. Again, recommend reading it on Fangraphs. And yeah, a lot of other people, I've listened to plenty of people talk about this week, which is good. I always think it's good. I think the past decade has been awesome for more visibility into the Negro Leagues. And I am a big fan of the history of those leagues as well. I think it's fascinating. And again, I think their greatness was in spite of MLB playing baseball and having it be white only. You know, I think that is part of why their history is special, is they did it themselves and they made a successful league themselves. So that's that. That's my take on the Negro Leagues. I think my last thing is that I think like it might have been the OPS or slugging or whatever leaderboard. Ty Cobb was at the top. Josh Gibson is now at the top officially. And I think that's hilarious. And Ty Cobb is probably turning in his rotten little grave right now seeing that. And I think that's phenomenal. And then the last thing I'll say about Josh Gibson There's this thing about Josh Gibson. He's one of, if not the greatest power hitter of all time. There's legend of him. I've read Cool Papa Bill, a biography on him. I've read a biography on Satchel Paige. Both of them mentioned Josh Gibson a bunch. Not only did they play together, but those were the biggest stars of the Negro Leagues at the time. And there's amazing stories of Josh Gibson and how powerful he was. You see photos of him. You see his freaking forearms. Forearms were probably bigger than most people's biceps. And you're like, yeah, that checks out. People called him the Black Babe, the Black Babe Ruth. Babe Ruth is the Black Babe Ruth. Like, that's what I want to say. And people also would, I loved the response to that too, where it's like, hey, no, Babe Ruth is the white Josh Gibson, but they're both black men. I just want to point that out. We can't call Josh Gibson the Black Babe Ruth because Babe Ruth is the Black Babe Ruth. Josh Gibson is Josh Gibson. He is himself. And if you doubt me, I look into it. Look into the history of Babe Ruth and if he was actually a white man or not. But I digress. Let's talk about Mariners baseball. So what did they do this week? The Mariners, as I read, they're in first place. And they just almost mopped the Astros. They got close. They got really close. The last episode that I released was before the National Series, and it was coming off a tough stretch of 7 games against the Orioles and the Yankees, but I thought winning 3 of 7 from those teams was fine. Those are the best teams in the league. We knew they're not quite at their level yet. As long as they won the series against the Nationals, I'd be fine with it because I didn't really expect them to sweep because I think the Nationals are kind of frisky. I mean, they're, what are they, like 500 right now? 25 and 29. Still, that's not terrible. They have good players, and the Mariners were facing Mackenzie Gore, who's been really solid this year and I really like. And the Mariners end up losing 2 of 3. They crushed them on Sunday. The offense came alive, but they scored 2 runs on Friday and Saturday against Mackenzie Gore and Trevor Williams. And then thankfully they put runs behind against Patrick Corbin. Not enough for my taste, but at least they didn't get swept by the Nationals. It caps off a 10-game road trip where they win 4 of 10. I would have liked to at least win 2 of 3 against the Nationals. That was a really tough 2 games to score 2 runs against the Nationals, and like their bullpen, not amazing. It is what it is. They come home. They have a homestand against Houston and the Angels, and they win the first 3 against Houston. And they just dropped the last one this afternoon. And that one was, I don't know. It felt almost too good to be true that they were going to mop the Astros at home. But they win 3 of 4 against the Astros at home. And that is a big success. It puts them a little bit more distance between them and the Stros. I think coming into this series, I think the Astros were 2.5 games back. And now they are 5.5. That's big. I think the biggest part of the series was to at least split, but you're at home. I appreciate that they ended up winning in very Mariners fashion. They won 3-2, 4-2, 2-1, and then lost 4-0. The offense looked pretty awful this week, except for the one game against the Nationals. The past week of Mariners baseball, the offense has been really bad. The only two, your 3 good hitters this week were Julio, Ty, and JP. Guys, you'd hope to be some of your best hitters moving forward, but we'll see. The rest of the team was poor, was so bad. The offense is looking rough. We had those couple weeks with Dylan Moore and Luke Raley carrying the offense, and now they've been sputtering. They've been scuffling this past week, and I hope they can get it right. But I am feeling the vibes are better with this team. It just feels like Mariners baseball. They just keep winning these close games. Feels like a Scott Service managed team. They just keep winning these close games. They can't keep getting away with it, and yet they keep getting away with it. It's astounding how they continue to do this. And their record is still like pristine when they score more than 3 runs. Like the pitching staff was awesome this week against the Astros. Logan Gilbert had the worst start of the week, or the worst start of the series, I should say, today. But he went 6, gave up 4 runs. That's still not a terrible start against the Stros. The offense didn't score any runs, So you can't win a game if you don't score runs, I'm pretty sure. But the pitching was phenomenal against the Astros this week. So the pitching, and I tweeted this out earlier, they're averaging around 4.4 runs per game going into the series. And the starters in this series pitched 24 innings, each of them threw six. They gave up 24 hits, 9 runs, walked 4, struck out 25, 3 quality starts, and Logan just missed one today. So they give up 9 runs in 24 innings, 24 hits. That's a 1. Actually, no. With 4 walks, that's a little over a 1 whip. That's a pretty low, damn low ERA. 9 runs in 24 innings against the Astros is great. And the bullpen was flawless. The bullpen was absolutely flawless this week. They pitched 13 innings against the Astros. They only gave up 3 hits. They only walked 1, and they struck out 13. Munoz has continued to look amazing. Spire looked better this week. Every reliever kind of looked better this week. Trent Thornton, they put him in for once without inherited runners. 2 games in a row, and he looked great with a clean inning. Fancy how that works. Mike Bauman had a really nice inning and got his first win as a Mariner last night. Taylor Saucedo is back, which is great news. It was a good series against the Astros to get the bullpen back on track for sure. The pitching just keeps on chugging. The pitching is just, there will continue to be bumps in the road away from home, I'm sure. But at home, this pitching staff's insane. They're just insane. I tweeted out earlier today as well. It was Thursday at work, but it was slow. I was watching the Mariners most of the day. The pitching staff is amazing. Everyone knows this. It's astounding that, especially in the year of the modern pitcher, we have week in and week out, we know the 5, and we just know they're going to be great. Like, obviously, there's going to be some hiccups, but there's not a, oh, it's his start today, oh man, you know, I have no feeling about that with any of these 5 starters. Like, our worst starters are Bryce Miller and Brian Wu after the three-headed monster of Kirby, Gilbert, and Castillo. And with Wu, I get so excited when both of those guys pitch. I get so excited with all 5 pitch. I was trying to think of how rare this is. Even elite rotations of the past, not necessarily Mariners-wise, like, might be carried by the top 3, as most are, but you don't ever have just, like, this pure upside on the back end like the Mariners do with Miller and Wu. It's so crazy. I think back, I was looking through the Mariners' history in the last, like, decade plus of what was the best pitching staff that isn't from, like, the 2020s. Because the 2020s, we've had some pretty damn good pitching staffs. Even, like, 2021, 2022 with Gonzalez and Flexen on the back end, those staffs were still pretty good. Now, obviously, this year and last year, maybe the best pitching staffs in Mariners history. There were some damn good ones in the 90s and early 2000s, but it's up for debate. But in the last, like, decade plus, who is the best pitching staff in Mariners history? And I think in Mariners history, wow, I cannot speak today, in recent Mariners history, and I think it is the 2014 pitching staff, and I'm looking at this holistically. I mean, you had the great seasons from James Paxton after this, but then even looking at the 2018 team was a lot better offensively and didn't necessarily have the elite pitching. It's a little bit different from how the team's based now. Like, that team had really good season from James Paxton. They had a great season from Wade LeBlanc. This is 2018, the Felix year where he kind of imploded, and that was it. Mike Leake gave them a lot of decent innings. Marco Gonzalez gave them a lot of good innings. Like, that was a fine enough pitching staff. They did enough for the offense to cook. But 2014, I think, was the last really good Mariners pitching staff before, like, this year and last year. It was Felix, who was still absolutely elite in 2014. Looking back at his stats are insane. 236 innings pitched with a 2.14 ERA for Felix and 248 strikeouts. I think it's safe to say no one on the Mariners pitching staff this year is going to do that. I'm still kind of upset that Corey Kluber won the Cy Young that year over Felix. I think Felix should have won. Whatever. Whatever. Corey Kluber had a great year. I just think Felix should have two Cy Youngs. But he anchored that staff, obviously. That's a shit ton of innings. Insane output. 170 ERA plus. But then you had, after that, you had Asashi Iwakuma. You had Chris Young, both with really solid years. And it wasn't the best Kuma year, but it was still a really solid Kuma year, because I think 2013 was his best year by far. That was, and 2012 even was really good. But 2014, it was no slouch. Chris Young, again, big tall man, GM of the Texas Rangers right now, had a solid year. Even Ronis Elias had a solid year. And then James Paxton in like 74 innings, so like half a season, had a really good output from those innings. But even then, that pitching staff was great. But even then, you had Erasmo Ramirez. You had a fifth day, or even a fourth and fifth day, when you're like, oh, it's Ronis Elias, or oh, it's Erasmo Ramirez. This pitching staff simply does not have that. Like, they don't have it at all. They have a, oh, it's this guy, I love that. Oh, it's this guy, I love it. Oh, it's like, there's, and then the rotation resets. There is no, oh, I don't want to watch that guy pitch. Like, it's insane. It's insane how good this pitching staff is. It's ridiculous. Ugh. Okay, that's enough gushing about the pitching staff. Some other things I want to touch on this week. Ryan Bliss got called up. Still has yet to have a hit. He pinch hit for Josh Rojas against Josh Hader the other night, in the bottom of the 10th, I believe. Or was it the 9th? It was like last night, and I'm already forgetting. That was a choice for sure. Luckily they won that game, or else the discourse would have been pretty bad. He has yet to have a hit. I talked about him in the preview. I wasn't super bullish on him because I just read a bunch of scout profiles about him, and it just doesn't seem like a lot of the stuff is off the charts besides the speed. I think he's going to be an okay, serviceable guy. He came up because Polanco is on the IL. He had a hamstring problem again after he came back, which begs the question, why didn't they just put him on the IL in the first place? Again, despite the bullet, give him the 10 days. I think it would have been better than if they tried to pussyfoot him back in day 7 of the bench. Whatever. Jonathan Class A is up again as well, and I just don't know. I don't know if it's it with him. I just don't know if he's ready to hit a major league level. I entertain the idea of he might be more valuable to the team than Mitch Haniger, but I don't think he's even going to be that much better defensively. I mean, it's the lowest bar possible. I think he is going to be better defensively than Haniger and obviously offer more on the base path. But I don't know. It looks bad at the plate. It looks real bad. And the fact that he started a couple platoon roles over Rayleigh is insane. Like, it's ridiculous. And with that news as well, with Bliss coming up, Polanco to the IL, Tyler Locklear got promoted to AAA. He gets to get a little taste of hitting in the PCL. And he's in AAA already. It is almost June. It's May 31st and this is coming out. I think it's even odds we see him in the next 2 months, maybe, if he rakes. I think we see him in 2024 no matter what at this point. I find it hard to believe they'd call him up to AAA, and if he does anything like he did in AA, they wouldn't just call him up with just the lack of depth at DH and third base and first base positions which he plays. I think I can see a world where maybe Ty France is traded at the deadline, potentially, and Tyler Locklear just gets the full call-up to first base. I mean, we'll see how he hits in the PCL. If he starts raking, we'll just have to see if it's really raking or if it's PCL raking. There's a distinction there. But he's that much closer to knocking on the big league door. And I talked about it a couple weeks ago. He's putting a little bit of pressure on this team. They got to figure something out. I think it's the perfect time to call him up. I think he probably spends June in Tacoma just hitting. If he's not terrible, like if he is absolutely awful and they have to send him back down to AA, that would suck. I don't think that's going to happen. I think they're just going to give him June to try to cook in AAA and then assess where's the team at going towards the trade deadline at the end of July? And what are they going to do? What has Ty France been doing in that time? What has Luke Raley been doing in that time? The two first basemen, two guys who can play first, I guess. Mitch Garver can too. What has Mitch Garver been doing at DH / maybe catching? If Mitch Garver's is bad, I don't know what they do. I don't know what they do. But Tyler Locklear, AAA, I'm excited. Okay, couple more things. It's probably going to be a quick show. They didn't do a bunch to disappoint me this week besides what we already know, and is that they're not good at offense. Luke Raley, while he's been quite good, May was a banner month for Luke Raley. The start was really slow, obviously. So his season-long numbers don't look amazing, but we know what he did in May. We saw what he did in May. His Savant page is ugly, and I'm not a holy Savant truther of this is how good a player is just based on how much blue and red he has, but it's a pretty damn good indication to me of what's going on. It looks so bad. It looks so much worse than I would have expected based on his production this month. The max exit velocity is good. The max exit velocity is an indicator to me that, you know, he has that in his locker. The average exit velocity is pretty low. His ex-WOBA, weighted on base average, is really low. It is really, really low, and that is alarming. His expected slug is also really low. Everything compared to last season is down, basically. His barrel percentage is plummeted, like 8%, which is one of the top barrel percentage differences of the season so far in the negative. His walk rate is 3%, which is awful. His K rate is down a couple percentage points. That's something. His hard hit rate's down damn near 10%, a little over 10%, actually, 10.5%. It's not good. It doesn't look good. It doesn't look good at all. I think his best role, his rolling ex-WOBA, it looks better, but that's because it started so damn low. I think Luke Raley's best role long-term is platoon corner outfielder who can also play first. And I'm okay with that. He offers you some speed and a lefty bat that can hit for power. And that is really good if he's going to be able to crush righties and play the outfield, okay? The problem is they do not have good enough bats to platoon him with. They can't platoon him with Jonathan Class A. That's like, I would take Luke Raley against lefties over Jonathan Class A at this point. The problem with wanting... The part of the problem with this offense and just the team building is they've built, like, a roster out of platoon bats. You can't build the whole boat out of platoons. You can have like two, maybe. So you have four guys alternating, lefty righty, two on the bench, two in. You know, maybe three. I'll give you three, three max. They have like Josh Rojas should probably be a minor platoon. Luke Raley should be a platoon. Mitch Haniger is just not good. Mitch Garver should be a lefty platoon at DH, probably, if you had a good enough lefty DH to play in front of him, which you clearly don't. It's an issue. So I think Luke Raley is going to probably play more like a regular, and he should on this team. On a serious baseball team, he probably shouldn't be an everyday player. He should probably be the third outfielder / platoon. But on this baseball team, he should probably be the everyday player because that's how they've built this team. It just doesn't look good. They worry me greatly. The expected WOBA is so bad. It's just so bad. And I'm worried. He had such a hot streak. He had a bad week. He had a really bad week this past week. I hope he can get it right. It's just, it worries me. The good thing is that Julio's been hitting better, so that's good. Julio had a great week. He had a couple home runs this week on pitches inside the plate, and he pulled fly balls on pitches inside, of the plate, and he had two home runs this week. Like, that is something we haven't seen all year really from him, and that's encouraging. He had five steals this week with the two home runs. He had a few runs. He hit 360. Just a good week from him. No walks, weirdly, but he didn't strike out very much. Just free swinging. He's just swinging a hot bat. He's hitting the ball really hard. He's looking more like himself, I'll say, which is good. Ty France also had a good week. Ty France had another home run. He's been hitting for more power recently, which is good to see. Still not quite as much as your first baseman should. The Ty France back meter, it's not all the way back yet to like what we saw in 2021. And that is just where it needs to be if he's going to be starting on a contending team at first base, I think, especially a team that needs offense like the Mariners. He sits at a 103 WRC plus on the season. That's just not, it's just not good enough. As a first baseman who's also not especially a good defender, even if he was a good defender, I still wouldn't really care that much. You have to rake at first base on a contending team. You just have to. And he's just not. He's also striking out a lot more this year. So if you're going to strike out a lot more, sell out for power like JP did last year, I need those home run numbers to jump up, buddy. And compared to last year, he already has six home runs in 50 games compared to last year where he played a whole year and hit 12. So that's encouraging at the very least, but it's the rest of the numbers still are just not good enough. His slugging isn't up from last year very much at all. It's 378 right now. It's 366 last year. He's not quite back. He's not cooked. I just don't. He seems more like a guy who'd be on the Marlins right now, or the Oakland A's, or the White Sox. He just seems like a first baseman who shouldn't be on a contending team. And I hate to say it because I really like Ty France. And I just hope he goes on a tear. I hope he hits 35 home runs this year. I just don't really see it. But he was good this week, I will say. He had a good week. JP also had a really good week. JP has looked very solid since coming back. Better than he did before he got hurt, at the very least. His plate appearances have looked a lot better. He's given you some JP stuff at the top of the lineup. You know, he's going to work the count. Hit a home run this week. Had a 113 WRC plus in the six games he played this week. They're going to need him to skew closer to his last year's production than the start of this season's production if they're going to want to win long term. And he just really looked terrible before he went out. So I hope he can get back on track. Last year was just an amazing season from him. I just hope he can replicate it. I'm not entirely sure if he can, but it's looked more encouraging this week, so that's very good. And then the last guy I want to talk about, Mitch Garver, man. Not good. Not good. Not good at all. This guy's a DH. You kind of want your DH to hit home runs from time to time, maybe even get on base from a guy who doesn't really chase much, who boasts, you know, a very high walk rate in his career. And I will say, as I'm looking at these numbers, he still is rocking a 12.2% walk rate. That's real solid. 31% K. Only five home runs so far in 47 games. He is slugging 313, which is really bad. That is so bad. 79 WRC plus. Negative 0.4 Fangraphs WAR. That is not what you want from your DH. I'll say it. I will say it. That is not entirely what you want from your designated hitter. They had him catch yesterday because apparently service thought it might help him get his bat back on track. Apparently, Mitch Garver's wife also thought that would get his bat back on track. It didn't really, but maybe we'll see it happen more, which begs the question, Sebi Savala, what do you exactly do here? If he's not going to be the backup catcher out and out, doesn't really need to be on the roster. But Mitch Garver, man, I want him not... numbers and, like, Mariners performance aside, I personally, I want him to to play better so he could just be happier. Like, the team is winning, and that's fine. But he seems like such a nice dude, such a cool guy. I just want him to rake for his own sake. And it just hasn't happened this year. Just I was like, this is the best signing of the offseason. This is one of the best signings they ever made. It was like very cost effective. I thought he was gonna crush lefties. They needed just a guy to sit in the DH spot all year. I thought he was gonna do that. He just hasn't done it. He's following the time honored tradition of hitters getting to Seattle and dying. Jorge Polanco also doing that this year. He's hurt too right now. He's following the other second base hole. Second base and DH, man. It's been cursed. Jack Z gave those contracts to Cano and Cruz. They worked out swimmingly, about as good as you could ask for. And since then, second base and DH have just been black holes for this team. Two spots you need offense from. Two spots you, like, again, DH, they don't play defense. Second base, you don't need a good defensive second baseman. Respectfully, it's like first base to me. You need to hit more than you can play defense. It would be good if you got a guy who could do both. That would be nice. But Jesus, it's so bad. It's so impressive. It's every season. Every season, I think they make some good signing, and it just, ugh. It's nothing. They come here and they die. Teoscar Hernandez comes here. He's the worst year of his career. He goes to the Dodgers. He's looking more like himself. Like Adrian Beltre, the prime example. Man, Luis Urias, I wasn't super high on him at all as a starting third baseman. I was more high on him as a reclamation project utility guy. He is in AAA right now, so that's going great. Seeing like the amount of people die after they come to Seattle makes me think that Nelson Cruz should be a first ballot Hall of Famer. Nelson Cruz came to Seattle as a free agent and had his best offensive years of his career in Seattle. He played damn near every game for four straight years. I think he probably missed a collective 30 to 40 games in those 4 years out of the 162 per season. He had his best offensive years of his career outside probably like the 2019 with the Twins. Playing some right field in the first two seasons and then basically being a DH only the last two, but essentially a DH only most of his time in Seattle. Put up his best offensive years of his career. Insanely good offensive years. Just average like 40 home runs a year, slugged 500 plus. He put up like 17 WAR as predominantly a DH / bad right fielder for 4 years in Seattle. 17 WAR from a DH, basically. That's insane. First ballot. He overcame the curse. I don't know how he did it. We got to ask him because I don't know how he did it. That should be on his Hall of Fame plaque. He overcame the curse of the dreaded Seattle Mariners free agent batter signing. I don't even know. It's just insane how this happens every year, and it's happening to Mitch Garver. It's so tough, and I hate it. Before I talk myself into a hole of despair, the team, again, they're 31-27. They're in first by a few games. I'm so damn skeptical of this team long term, but I'm just enjoying it while I can. Whatever they do, they provide entertainment at the very least. They're quite chaotic. They always provide entertainment. The front office will spice things up with trades. And I guess, you know, I'm thankful they're in first place. But before I get out of here, looking forward to the schedule in June. I think I talked about this at the start of the season, or near the start of the season. The April and May schedules looked pretty difficult. And it was true. They were pretty hard, and they come out of it. I mean, they still have a game against the Angels to cap off May, but whatever happens in that game, it doesn't change my feelings on the team right now. Right, they're 31-27 in first place. A lot of my good feelings are coming from the fact that the Astros have looked pretty bad for most of the year, and the Rangers have looked very mad. The Rangers have honestly looked as expected. It's just their offense hasn't been quite as good, but the pitching has looked has looked rough with all their injuries they started the year with. Same with the Astros, for the most part. Both of those have looked expected. The Rangers' offense floundering this much, like Marcus Semien hasn't really got going, and some of their other guys just haven't really been able to repeat the hot year they had last year so far, I'll say. Long year. But that's making me feel a lot better about the team. But they're 31-27 after two pretty tough months of baseball. And looking into June, I looked at this in April and I said, oh, that is an easy schedule. If they can get through the first 2 months, this is the opportunity to put some separation between them and the division. It's a big, big opportunity because this month is light. And the rest of the year, according to strength of schedule numbers, is pretty light. So, in June, they start the series against the Angels in May. They end it in June. Then they go to the A's, to the Royals, home for the White Sox and Rangers, and then they go to the Guardians, Marlins, and Rays, and then finish at home with the Twins. So you play the Angels, the A's, the White Sox, and the Marlins, all in the same month. That is a lot of teams you should beat. The Royals being good kind of throws a wrench into my April thoughts because I thought that would be a team that would be easier to beat. But I guess going into Kansas City, we saw last year, it doesn't matter how good the team is. Some stupid shit's going to happen there. But you get the White Sox, probably the worst team, maybe the worst team in the league. They haven't been as bad as they were in April. Angels are one of the worst teams in the league. The A's are a little frisky, but they're not great. The Marlins, again, one of the worst teams in the league. You probably see three of the five worst teams in the league in this month. And then you see the Rays, who haven't been awesome. You see the Twins, who also haven't been awesome. And then you see the Guardians and the Royals, who've both been great. So, and the Rangers, who've been like, meh. You know what the Rangers are. It's such a difference between their first couple months where it just felt like they were playing good team after good team after good team, and they were, basically. But they sit four games above 500, and looking forward to this month, I'm worried. I'm worried about this month because I say it is an easy month, and yet the team hasn't really been inspiring too much confidence in me, really. And the fact that the schedule is supposedly the easiest to end the year at this point. Their strength of schedule is literally 30th right now, according to tankathon.com, for the rest of the year. That worries me greatly. Because that just means they should win this division. Like, honestly, like, right? Like, if they have the easiest strength of schedule moving forward, that just means there's a lot of games they should win. And that worries me because I don't know if this team is a team that wins games they should win. They win a lot of games they shouldn't. If you know what I'm saying. So it's like it makes me a little nervous. But talking about strength of schedule to end the episode here, the Mariners apparently again they have the easiest strength of schedule remaining according to tankathon.com. I think it just takes the teams like winning the records and says who you're gonna play. The Mariners, the strength of schedule left is the teams have a 47% win percentage. That's not very good. The toughest opponents, according to this website, for the Mariners remaining, 3 against the Phillies, 3 against the Yankees, 3 against the Guardians, 3 against the Orioles, 3 against the Dodgers, and 3 against the Royals. But then, on their easiest opponents remaining, 7 against the White Sox, 3 against the Marlins, which comes this month, 13 more against the Angels, which is every game the Angels have played, which is crazy that it is almost June and we haven't played the Angels yet. I'm still kind of getting used to the balanced schedule. They have 3 against the Mets, 10 more against the A's, and then 7 more against the Astros. That one is like the Astros right now, the win percentage isn't good, but we know that team's probably better than 25-32. But still, that's you know, you get 13 against the Angels, they're awful. 7 against the White Sox, 10 more against the A's, 3 against the Marlins this month. A lot of games they should win. A lot of games they really should win. And that's what makes me worried. But I'll cut it off there. I appreciate you all listening to the Chaos Ball Podcast. I'll be back next week, probably. But in the meantime, let's hope they can sweep the Angels this week at home and get off to the easy month of June on the right foot and stay in first place for as long as they can. But again, thank you for listening. And of course, have a good rest of your week and go Mariners.